Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, we examine the pop culture phenomenon, Purple Rain. The origins, the production, and the ultimate legacy of Purple Rain is detailed in a terrific new book by author and film critic John Kenneth Muir. You could read more about Mr. Muir's work and purchase his book, Music on Film, Purple Rain, by visiting his website at johnkennethmuir.com.
Heard about the club and I thought I'd try my luck.
You in the business?
Well, I'm a singer.
Oh.
First Avenue's really famous. A lot of bands make it after playing there. It must be real exciting.
Is that what turns you on?
What do you mean?
Making it.
It'd be nice for a change. It's all I dream about. And you? What do you dream about?
So tell me about the decision to go with Purple Rain. What inspired that for you?
Well, the Music on Film series, which is published by Limelight Editions, was looking for another book for me after I wrote the Music on Film, This is Spinal Tap volume. And I knew immediately what I wanted to do, and that was Purple Rain. And you can just mark me down as Mr. 1984, I guess, because Spinal Tap and Purple Rain were both from the year 1984. But back in, I guess, 2006, 2007, I had written a book called The Rock and Roll Film Encyclopedia, and I got to interview a number of directors who made musical, you know, rock films, including Albert Magnoli, the director of Purple Rain. And I always remembered that interview because I just have to say Mr. Magnoli is just like this exuberant, buoyant dynamo. He's just a great interview. And I have always loved Purple Rain since I first saw it in the theaters back in 1984. And I thought, you know, this would be a really interesting film to go back to because not many people had really written much about Purple Rain. There are plenty of Prince biographies out there, and the one thing I didn't want to do was write another Prince biography because I think he's sort of an enigma, and I think it's hard to get the full story of him. So I thought, you know, in some sense, with Prince coming out of the mist in Purple Rain and then receding back into the mist, you know, Purple Rain is the thing to look at. So I wanted to focus on that film and sort of the presentation of Prince there. And, you know, unfortunately, I think the film is magnificent, but some people, you know, we seem to be in this culture where it's like everything that's like from the 1980s or 1970s is dismissed as cheesy or camp or whatever. And, you know, you'll read stuff online like the cheesiest movies and, you know, you'll see Purple Rain there. And I thought, you know, that's really not fair. If you go back and watch it, I mean, you certainly it's a, you know, the costumes are kind of flamboyant and stuff like that, but the filmic basis for the film is incredibly strong. I mean, it's just a beautifully rendered film, I think. So I thought, you know, let's go back and take a look at it and you know, see what's there.
Well, I know that's a common complaint about it, and there are other movies in this camp too that a lot of people will say. The only kind of worthwhile thing about the film is the soundtrack, or the only thing that lasts. But so tell me about what it is that you think works about the film itself.
Well, I think Purple Rain was a pioneer in its time, and in that it took the idea of the rock biography, or even the backstage musical to some extent, like 42nd Street, and brought it into the 80s and modernized it. You know, in terms of style, Purple Rain was not influenced by MTV, but it did influence MTV. You know, the idea of, well, look, I can pull points out of this movie, and it's basically a music video. You know, it was able to use a new kind of editing very much of the times that, you know, where you sort of had self-contained pieces of the film. And, you know, this was going on at that time. not just on MTV, but in films like Flashdance. So, you know, it was one of those pioneers from that time saying, hey, you know, this is another way we can do the musical. But more to the point for me, I suppose, is that I consider, like, the greatest thing a film can do, you know, the highest plateau of art it can aspire to is this idea that form and content are interwoven, that the form reflects the content or mirrors it in some way or augments it in some way. And I think you really have that in Purple Rain, particularly how the songs reflect character, they reflect where you are in the story, and the visuals, you know, really reflect what's happening in the music. So, you know, there's this real connection there. It's not just like, here, we're randomly having a song. It's like the songs are very important thematically to the film, and they tell you things about the characters that then you don't necessarily have to state in the film. You know, I think it's really terrific, you know, from the opening cross-cutting of Let's Go Crazy, where literally, you know, Prince steps out of the mist of mystery, you know, and invites us to participate in this, you know, to the end where he's singing, you know, Baby, I'm a Star, where, you know, I mean, literally, you've seen him become a star through the course of the movie. You fall in love with the guy. He's a charismatic performer, you know. So I just think that Purple Rain really thrives and survives because there's a sense of film artistry there. You know,
yeah.
I'm not sure why people deride it as cheesy. I don't find it particularly cheesy. No.
I never thought it was cheesy, no. I thought it dealt with some kind of hardened themes.
Yeah.
I didn't think, yeah, it couldn't be cheesy. This kind of the subject matter of the film was kind of went to some dark places.
Yes, you are so right. And that's one of the things I love about it. You know, I talked in my interview with the film's director about sort of this warts and all approach. And he said, well, you know, we never talked about it like that. But, I mean, it is sort of, it's not, this isn't, you know, the glossy prepackaging of Prince as a movie star. This
mm-hmm.
is like, boom, you know, a pretty authentic look at what the scene is like that Prince is a part of. And it doesn't candy coat who he is necessarily, or what world he comes from, or his history, or even his temperament. I mean, he can be a little bit of a prickly bastard in the film, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like, you know, today in Hollywood, they would never do that. They would never do that. They would never let a musical star, you know, let this be his vehicle for success, is to show all these different colorations and shades of his personality. So that's one of the things I very much like about the film, is that it does go to those darker places, and it's not afraid to go there. But at the same time, it doesn't try to sell you this image of him as, you know, broody, angst-ridden superhero or anything either. I mean, he's a guy with some faults, and he's a guy with some strengths, and he's obviously a artistic genius, and you know,
mm-hmm.
you just get all those shades from the film, I think.
Well, and the line between how much is kind of pulled from his own life and experience,
right,
and how much is fictional in the creation of this character, the kid, that's a little blurred as well, isn't it?
It absolutely is. You know, Prince has said in interviews, well, you know, we were making a fiction. It's a fictional story, and that's what I was acting. But there's enough of the reality of Prince's life in there for you to feel like you're getting a legitimate sense. Even if 100% of the details aren't, like, you know, absolutely true, you're still getting a feeling that you're getting a true sense of who he is as a person and as an artist. You know, things may have been changed for, you know, dramatic purposes or whatever, but the overall feeling is that it's authentic and that it's true. And I think that's sort of what carries over in the film, the sense of, this is really this guy. And, you know, you can contrast that with other vehicles for music stars, where they want to come out and be seen as likable and jocular and fun, like, you know, Hard to Hold with Rick Springfield. You know, he comes out and he's a jokester and a prankster, and, you know, but it's generally pretty terrible, you know. It's like, oh, there's, you know, he put nothing authentic of himself, you know, forward in that film. You know, I don't know if that was his decision or anybody else's. You know, he may just have been carried along in it, but the idea was there. It's like, you know, let's do bubblegum. Let's make
mm-hmm.
you a bubblegum star. And, you know, Purple Rain, it's not a bubblegum movie. You know, that's the difference.
Right.
And tell me where he where Prince was in his career at the time. He just come out with 1999.
That's right. That's right. He was beginning to have, much more success. The inklings of a more devoted and larger fan base, but he hadn't really played in Peoria yet, so to speak. Mm-hmm. To use a cliche. And the idea was, I mean, he was just an extremely clever businessman, still is, that, you know, he was going to sign up with his managing group again, but only if they got him a movie. It was very forward-thinking. I mean, this was a guy who, yes, was amazingly talented, but it's like, man, he was not an easy sell as far as a movie star, just traditionally speaking. I mean, he's on the shorter side in terms of stature. He was known for androgyny to some extent, if he was known at all. You know, he wasn't from Hollywood. He wasn't a creature of Hollywood. He was a creature of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And, you know, so he's like, wow, he wasn't even really an easy fit for a movie. But they ended up, you know, present him in a way that people really liked him and liked his scene and wanted to know more. And, you know, the film, of course, set off a fad or trend, you know. Well, you know, Prince fashions, Prince music, you know, people right. wanting to visit the Mecca of Minneapolis, you know. So he had a well-established career before Purple Rain, but Purple Rain, rocketed him to superstardom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what was its origins? What was its purpose when it first got started, the film?
Purple Rain?
Yeah.
Well, Prince knew he could be a movie star, and that's what he wanted to be. You know, and so the calculus was then simply, you know, what kind of story can we tell about Prince that seems true to Prince's experience and, you know, who he is as a person and as a musician and a performer and such. And I think that was always the impetus to do it, was to sort of reveal his world and show to people, you know, this is who I am. And then hopefully people would be attracted to that image. And of course they were, you know, it was Purple Rain sort of shattered all pre-existing conceptions about, like, what kind of an audience a film like this would be. You know, I know that the director, Mr. Manley, was told, well, this is going to play essentially to, black teenagers in urban environments. And he said, no, I've made a crossover film, and this is going to play everywhere. And, of course, it did. I mean, it was the film that actually knocked Ghostbusters from its number one perch at the box office that year, which is just a stunning idea that, that this low-budget film about a somewhat androgynous-seeming black music performer could have this crossover success.
Yeah.
And preview audience after preview audience loved the film, whether the preview audience was in, you know, sort of more urbane Southern California or was in Texas. You know, it's like, wow, the film, people responded to the film. And I think that's sort of a testament to its authenticity, in fact, it doesn't really talk down to people, and it doesn't try to really candy coat what Prince's reality is, you know, growing up or what have you, his family
right.
life, things like that.
Well, we've been talking about that this movie could have been just kind of like some kind of PR project to get Prince to play in certain areas that he wasn't, like Peoria. But it's anything but that. Who do you kind of credit with that? Magnoli?
Well, you know, I mean, film is a collaborative art form, and even though I often write about the auteur theory and stuff like that, I think you do have to look at, director Magnoli. I think you have to look at Prince and what the essence of, of the Prince persona is, and I think you have to look at the producer Robert Cavallo. I think that, you know, the three of them, in their different roles, I think they're all responsible, you know, for the success of the film. I think that Prince showed that he was capable of really of trusting Magnoli, of a director, and going in the direction that director wanted, and really committing to that direction. I mean, if Prince hadn't wanted to slap a character or be slapped, you know, if he had been out to protect his image, and that's it, you know, protect this very narrow image of the music star, then he probably wouldn't have gotten on board with some of the things that happened in the film. But he did commit. He committed to making a more dramatic picture. And I think, I mean, I do credit Mr. Magnoli a lot as well, because I think that he had a sense that the only way that Purple Rain would work and connect to people was if it seemed authentic, if it seemed true in some sense to Prince's world, even if we didn't always know the specifics of that world, if we hadn't sort of been aware of it. But you know, he made a world that was true to the people that made the film. You know, he was in that environment and, you know, in those clubs, you know, with Prince and such. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for not trying to make that world something it wasn't, for again, you know, I keep saying candy coat it, but for not candy coating it, for not making it, for not making it sort of more acceptable, politically, you know, correct, that kind of thing. I mean, there's scenes in there where Prince is really not nice. He's not particularly nice to Wendy and Lisa when they have a song they want him to perform in the film, and he's you know, he's downright contemptuous of them at points, and you know, it just shows different shades of the artist, his brilliance, but also that, you know, that performance of Darling Nikki is absolutely brutal. It's an onstage put down of you know, Apollonia's character in the film. It's not all sunshine and roses, which, again, I think is often the temptation when you're taking a movie star, and I mean a music star, and trying to put them in a movie.
Yeah.
That you sort of turn them into a white knight. And Prince, though obviously incredibly talented and gifted, he comes across as anything but that. He comes across as a real human being in the film.
Very troubled, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
There are a couple of kind of trivia anecdotes in the movie that I thought were just delicious. One was that originally it was Vanity and in the Apollonia role, and she left because she got an offer to do Mary Magdalene in Last Temptation of Christ. I didn't know that.
No, I didn't either. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I totally love Mr. Magnoli. When he described that scene to me, you know, he said, you know, Vanity came to me and she said, "What would you do?" And he said, you know, "That would be easy. I'd go do the Martin Scorsese movie." You know, I don't have to put up on a pedestal what I'm doing here. Go do that. But just make sure they're really doing it. You know, and that was good advice because, you know, there were some difficulties in the making of that film and she ended up not being in it. You know, so.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's tough, but, I mean, the great thing to consider is, you know, what would a Purple Rain movie have looked like with Vanity as opposed to Apollonia, and I think that, you know, I think that Vanity would have given it an even harder edge, which on one hand may have been very interesting, but on the other hand, we look at Apollonia, and in some ways she's our entree to the world, because she arrives in the taxi cab at the beginning of the film and sort of becomes caught between these two very powerful personalities, which would be, you know, Prince and Morris Day, and, you know, and sort of we sort of sympathize with her a little bit. You know, if Vanity had been there, being a little more hard-edged, perhaps being a little more manipulative seeming herself, I don't know that we would have found such an easy entree into the world. You know, I don't
right.
know. It would be fascinating. I would love to have both versions side by side, you know, see a Vanity version and an Apollonia version. I'm a fan.
I think you're right. I think you're right about Apollonia and the quality that she brings to it, as opposed to someone like Vanity.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Apollonia has that innocence, that purity. You don't ever believe, you know, even though she's there to become a star and that's what she wants, you don't believe that she's bad. You don't believe that she's sort of manipulating other people to get what she wants. You just believe she's trying to get ahead, so to speak, you know, and trying to find the best way to do that. You know, she doesn't come across as a particularly cunning character, and I think Vanity had more of that aspect to her, you know, just in terms of her persona.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting, while we're talking about the kind of the supporting characters in the piece, I mean, the person that really pops, I remember reading the Pauline Kael review, and she was talking about this as being a special aspect of the film, that Morris Day comes across as just a very special comedian, almost.
Yeah.
But how much of that was kind of just factored into the script just by the nature of who Morris Day was?
Well, you know, the evolution of Purple Rain makes that a little difficult to know for sure, because I know I asked Mr. Magnoli, I said, you know, there's almost an Abbott and Costello routine in here. It's like, who's on first? They're almost, Jerome and Morris Day are almost doing a variation of that.
Mm-hmm.
Was that in your script? He said, you know, that's actually one of the things that came out of the William Blinn script that you know that they then changed and went into, so, you know, something different. So, So, you know, I think it was factored in by, you know, by William Blinn, who was the author of the original material, and then by Mr. Manley, who wrote the script they shot, that, you know, he's a bit of a character, you know, that he adds this element to the film. And I think, you know, he and Jerome, you know, a lot of people quote them as, you know, one of the reasons why the film is so successful. You know, and it's not just that, you know, every story needs a villain and kind of a delicious villain, but, you know, they open up another side of Prince's world. You know, you see these people who are sort of working against him, and that's important, you know,
mm-hmm.
to have that. But they're not like black hats either. They're just funny, and you know the things they say are hysterical. They're just very. I think they're great characters. They add so much to Purple Rain. They're just so funny. You know,
another thing that surprised me. I guess it didn't surprise me, but I was pleased to read, was that they culled through hundreds of unreleased Prince songs to kind of pull the soundtrack for this film. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. And I think it shows in the film because all the music is so good and all the music fits so much the beats of the film and augments the, you know, the thematic narrative bits of the film. You get the feeling, wow, they did. They must have picked through hundreds, and they must have really been able to choose the ones that best worked for their material. And they really do work. I said, like, Darling Nikki, you know, it's not actually, you know, it's not Darling Apollonia, you know, it's not that far, but you know exactly what he's saying, and that's when he's performing that song, and she's in the audience. I mean, you know it exactly. You know, so they were able to do a really good and really sort of canny job of matching, you know, the pre-existing catalog of those unreleased songs to what was happening in the film. I think it's pretty amazing. I mean, from the trajectory of the beginning, you know, Let's Go Crazy, the cross-cutting, to where you arrive at the end, you know, Baby, I'm a Star. I mean, you know, this is sort of the journey that makes Prince a star. I mean, and the songs chart him the whole way. I just love that. I think it's great.
So, I mean, the movie was, you said that it tested very well. It beat Ghostbusters for number one at the box office. What was it that you think people responded to most in the movie?
Well, I think it was that again, Prince, in showing some aspect of himself, he didn't hide certain unattractive things from us, and that it's like, wow, I can relate to this guy. You know, I mean, that's the amazing thing. I mean, you see this sort of short and stature guy who would, you know, sometimes wear high heels and fur coats, kind of thing, and you're like, wow. I get it. He came from a, you know, a broken home. He's had to deal with these things. And look, here he is, you know, his talent just, you know, coming through, you know, despite all these things that happened, maybe even because of it. I think that people were inclined to see, you know, how much Prince had made of himself, and he really did. I think the film really showcased that. I mean, it didn't hurt either that the critics just absolutely, you know, fell over themselves, you know, praising the film, which I think is really merited. I mean, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert had it on their best, their 10 best of the year list, which is really pretty amazing, you know, to think about, and how many films are made a year, and, you know, Purple Rain is up there. I mean, I'd certainly agree. You know, other critics, I mean, I talked a little bit about in the book, you know, another critic, you know, compared it to Citizen Kane, you know, just because it was sort of deconstructing old ideas about the musical and recreating new ideas around, you know, that format, around how you present it, around who can be a star, all kinds of stuff. I think it's hard to know why a film hits, but I think the people who saw it probably on that opening weekend really liked it, and they told their friends, you know, something like that. You know, nothing beats word of mouth. I think, you know, the people who saw it probably went back to see it again, and they told other people, you know, this is great. You know, every now and then there's a movie like that, and, you know, all the discussion about hype these days and things like that. There's a lot of manufactured hype around movies today, but, you know, I have to think that anything that came out of Purple Rain wouldn't have been based on manufactured hype. It would have been based really on, you know, the people who saw the film and how much they appreciate it and how good it was.
Yeah, and there's also always a kind of indefinable element. I mean, for a movie to hit the zeitgeist like that one did.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the right time. Just it was in the air at the time, you know.
That, you know, you're absolutely right. It's like, you know, it's catching lightning in a bottle. I don't, you know, I don't know exactly how they did it. You know, I don't know if Prince was primed to go that big. I don't know if it was because When Doves Cry hit so big right before the film came out, you know, they released it, I guess, you know, at that time. It was written for the film, but that came out and people loved it. You know, it's like, boom, people were just primed for that movie. And I don't think it was manufactured hype. I do think it's just like what you said. It was something in the zeitgeist that people were becoming ready for Prince, for the Purple Rain of Prince.
You know, and he's never been as revealing as he was there. I mean, since that time, we don't get a sense necessarily that we know him in a comfortable way.
Right. Absolutely. I like to say he's receded into that mist. You know, he's gone. And, you know, his films after Purple Rain sort of lacked a sense of humor, and they were sort of more distant thing. You know, his second film, Under the Cherry Moon, was really pretty terrible. You know, it was this black and white kind of screwball musical comedy thing that, you know, instead of showing us Prince, it put up another layer of separation between us and Prince, and I think that's why it didn't do well. I think Prince's magic, you know, comes from, in part, you know, his who he is, and it seemed like too much of a stretch or something to put him in that other time and that other kind of format. It's like, wow, this isn't why I like Prince. You know, it was very different.
Yeah. And yet, at the same time, Sign of the Times is one of the great concert films, but Graffiti Bridge, which was his kind of return to that character, didn't work.
No, it didn't work, and it's another, you know, I would say weak film, and I think if you look at it, it's that it doesn't seem to have a sense of humor about Prince. It doesn't, you know, it's almost too much about the preciousness of Prince in some way.
Yes, yes.
You know, and, you know, I think both of those later films suffer from that flaw. Purple Rain was, boom, here it is, the whole picture, the whole enchilada, this is me. This, you know, it could have been called This Is Prince, you know. And you see him, you know, with that little puppet making those sounds. And so, you know, you see him doing funny things, you see him doing rotten things, but you still root for him. You know, he's just a kind of developed person in Purple Rain, which he's not in those other films. They're sort of more taken with protecting who he is rather than revealing who he is,
right,
to some extent. At least I feel that way.
Is there, if they come back to you about doing another Music on Film book, are there films that you're particularly passionate about that can fit that mold?
Yes, yeah, I would love to do another Music on Film book. I love writing these books. You know, my next one, I would love to do Rock and Roll High School or... Or Eddie and the Cruisers.
Is that a 1984 movie, Eddie and the Cruisers?
It is. So that should be the one. That should really be the one, I think. I think that was maybe it was 83.
That would be something else, Eddie and the Cruisers. I like that idea.
Yeah, I would love to do it. I got to talk with the director for my Rock and Roll Film Encyclopedia, and I loved him, too. I'd love to go back to him and write more about that film.
Well, what was it about the... What kind of characterized the films of the 80s in their use of music that made them unique, do you think?
Well, for me, it was really sort of, you know, the exploding of the old genre. You know, the 70s did that to some extent. I mean, you know, films like Cabaret are just staggeringly good in the 70s.
Yeah.
And, you know, they really changed the essence of what the musical is. And, oh, you know, just, you know, what a brilliant film that is. But I think that, you know, the path of the great path of film history, for better or worse, is that it started out as being filmed plays. So we're talking about starting out as very theatrical and artificial, and as we move forward in time, films become more gritty, more naturalistic. And you know, I think that's the direction that we're going. And you know, in some ways, the musical is the most theatrical and artificial of all genres. So it's had a hard time developing over the decades. You know, figuring out how to do that. You know, we can accept anything as far as, you know, monsters and stuff like that in our films, but it's hard to accept the idea of somebody breaking into song, you know.
Right.
What makes you do that? You know, whereas for previous generations, that was just instantly accepted. That's what the musical was. And, you know, when I look at the 80s, and I look at how rock and roll was changing, and I look at how film was changing, you know, I see, you know, Spinal Tap, with its technique of a mock documentary, you know, showing one path towards realism almost. Well, listen, you know, you can't discount the music in Spinal Tap. It's hysterical. It's great in its own mm-hmm. way. But, you know, the milieu around that is this mockumentary, you know, this last waltz-ish kind of mockumentary of a band, you know, in its death throes, essentially. And so there is some sort of aspect. I mean, people mistook it for real. You know, they thought this is a real band. This is, you know, this is a real documentary. You know, so, you know, there was the realism thing. And, you know, and I think Purple Rain, with its music video cutting and stuff like that, was saying, look, this is another way you can do a musical today and still have people really like it. You know, I think that both of those films were really trying to point to ways that the musical format could survive. I mean, because if you cut out all the stuff around Purple Rain and, you know, the 1980s stuff, I mean, it's a backstage musical. It's, you know, 42nd Street, whatever. It's something like that. But it's changed things as well. You know, it's got an unconventional hero. It's got music video style cutting. You know, it's not Busby Berkeley, you know, type
right.
of stuff. You know, it's things that fracture space and time and stuff like, you know, and it's also charting a very real scene, the Minneapolis scene. So, you know, I look at these 1980s films and I see them struggling, and I think very successfully, with the idea of how to update the musical for modern audiences so that modern audiences can get into them again. You know, but it's funny, I don't think that necessarily people look at Spinal Tap as a musical. You know, I think it was so successful in what it did that people tend not to look at it that way. I mean, it didn't make a lot of money at the time. When I say so successful, I mean, it's beloved as a cult film.
Right,
you know,
right.
It wasn't a success financially, so, you know, and you know, now people don't really say, oh, that's a musical. But if you look at other things Chris Guest has done, like Mighty Wind, well, again, it's a backstage musical, right?
Right, right.
Right, so.
Go ahead.
Right, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Well, what strikes me is when we talk about musicals of today, whether they're on stage or in film, it seems like a trend might be taking those movies, many of them from the 80s, and remaking them or adapting
right.
them for the Broadway stage. It used to be that we made movies out of the best Broadway musicals, and now it's the opposite. You know,
yeah.
It's
that's
a trend.
That's a really good observation. That's a smart insight, because I think in some ways that's reinforcing, you know, the argument I'm making, that in some ways these films, you know, were ahead of their time, because now we finally caught up with them and saying, oh yeah, let's do a musical of that, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, so yeah, like Footloose or what have you. So it's like, the, you know, time has finally caught up with that. We say, oh yeah, this was good. You know, at the time, when you look at some of the early 80s things, you know, people were in general, by people, I mean critics, complaining about quick cutting and stuff like that, and, you know, oh, you know, these young actors today, they dance with their faces, you know what I'm saying, because they've
right.
done doubles and things like that. You know, I think, you know, it's always, oh, I don't know, it's the job of the critic, but I think a critic's function that they sometimes fulfill is always to sort of be the old guard and say, well, this isn't like what it used to be. Because critics look back and they say, okay, this is what we use as a guidepost. And like, all other films were like this. So they don't always know how to reckon with something new and fresh. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like, oh,
mm-hmm.
well, it's never been done like this, so it shouldn't be done with this. And I think that's how they make a mistake sometimes, because if you look at Flashdance or Footloose or whatever, no, it's not Fred Astaire, pretty clearly, you know. But it is an attempt to revive that form using the language that, you know, the generation of young people in the 80s would understand. You know, the same thing with Spinal Tap. I mean, I've watched Spinal Tap with people who get up and leave in it. They don't get this, they just think it's horrible. They think this is making fun of these people, this is trashing these people, I've got to get out of here, this is so mean-spirited. And in fact, it's not really mean-spirited, it's not really trashing anybody, you know. It's
right.
It's, you know, but some people, you know, just don't get that. They just don't get it, you know, and it's the idea of the shock of the new, you know, and I think that's very true of how Spinal Tap was received. But, you know, interestingly, Purple Rain got great reviews. You know, the shock of the new didn't seem to prevent people from enjoying Purple Rain. You know, if anything, it's like now people want to say, no, it wasn't that good. Now people want to go back and say, oh, it was cheesy, it was the mid-80s. Big hair, big collars, you know, ruffles, whatever. You know, it's like they want to dismiss it now. And, you know, I would say, no, look, this is, you know, this was great work just as film art in that time.
Yeah.
You know, and so to dismiss it, you know, feels very wrong. Just because today we don't wear our hair that way or wear clothes that look like that, I mean, that's ridiculous, right? So.
Yeah, then look at the greatest films of the 70s. I mean, we weren't wearing bell bottoms. We're not wearing bell bottoms today, but that doesn't make the movie itself any less relevant, you know.
Right, right. And some people seem to really believe that argument. You know, sometimes I think even George Lucas does, you know, when he's trying to by taking out the special effects of the original Star Wars and such. It's like he's saying, "You know what? This film has to appeal to all generations forever, so anything that can mark it as being of the 70s, like how we did special effects in the 70s, must be removed." You know, like, oh.
Well, it's true, and what you're saying about the kind of the resistance of anything new and forward-thinking, I mean, it's definitely present today, and I see that. Even last year, if you look at all the movies that were kind of a lot of the movies that were popular last year, they were all about nostalgia.
Right.
The Artist, Midnight in Paris, Hugo. I mean, all great movies, but there was something that people connected to where they wanted to return to kind of a different time in the past.
Well, that's another really good observation. And, you know, I don't know if that is because people are unhappy with where our culture now is, and there's some sort of solace in the way things were done and the way things did look. But, you know, I think there's a price for that. I think there's a price for having your art always look backwards. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you look at something like Spinal Tap or Purple Rain, they were works of art that really looked forward. I mean, you know, I don't know if I stressed this enough in the book, but the idea that, you know, a guy who's maybe 5'2", he's black, like I said, he sometimes wears high heels and, you know, feminine clothing, he's androgynous, that this guy could front a motion picture that's a huge blockbuster success and he becomes a sex symbol, you know, in white conservative America of the moral majority in Reagan era, that's pretty astounding. That is pretty astounding. And I think it speaks to what, you know, how true and authentic Purple Rain seems. And then people, even though it's a very local story of this kid in Minneapolis, it's also, you know, the global story of people sort of striving to be better and to overcome where they came from and become who they know they can be. You know, so it's this really delicate equation between something that's extremely local and narrow and making it appealing by being so true and universal, you know, to so many people.
I think that hits upon why the movie was the success it was. I think you just articulated it. The kind of the need to break out of the constrictions of that time. And I don't know that that could be done today. I mean, it's gotten so much more constrictive and aggressive that I don't think people would be open to that kind of thing today.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Today there's like an extremely efficient machine. I mean, it is a machine. It's like a media machine that for anybody who steps out of what the expected boundaries are, that person is immediately slimed and pushed back. Like, I don't think a prince could break, you know, Prince could break out today. You know, I think we've become so polarized in this country that, you know, For everyone who would like him, there'd be other people who were saying why he can't be liked, you know.
Right.
You know, what's wrong? What's wrong with his lifestyle? What's wrong with his clothes? What's wrong with this? You know, we've gotten really good about judging other people, I think, in this country, and that's not a very conducive environment for creating art, in my opinion. If you feel that you're going to be very criticized and put down and attacked by, you know, fully 50% of the population, you know, 24 hours a day on cable news, you know, you're not, that's not very conducive to making art, in my opinion.
Right, right. Here we go again. We always do this, whether we talk about De Palma or horror films, we always do the philosophical and the political, and it even happens with Purple Rain, so.
Absolutely.
Okay, what's the password?
You got it.
Got what?
The password.
Password is what?
Exactly.
The password is exactly?
No, it's...
Hold it. Slow down. The babe walks in, you see her,
I see her,
you come get me,
I come get you,
and I probably have a couple little sexes on standby, so you glide by me and you say what?
Okay.
The password is okay?
As far as I'm concerned.
Damn it, say the password.
What?
Say the password, onion head.
The password is what?
That's what I'm asking you.
It's the password.
The password is it?
The password is what?
It. You just said so.
The password isn't it. The password is
what?
Got it.
I got it?
Right.
It or right.
What?